Okay, I guess we'll start the legacy committees, advisory committees hearing. It's, I think the first order of business we have is calling the roll. Oh, what do you need? Oh.
Representative Kepnick?
Here.
Kreitz?
Here.
Senators Dotsenrod?
Here.
Klein?
Here.
Sharp?
Here.
Hardmire?
Here.
Fong?
Here.
Okay, we got a quorum. If you, do you need to take off, Senator Dotsenrod?
I'll be able to stick around for just a few minutes, and I should be back in about 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, then the consideration of the minutes for the November 15th, 12 meeting. Were those sent out or anything? I think they were. I know I got them and stuff. Yeah, I got them. Was there any questions on them? You didn't get, didn't need them? Just basically the minutes, this meeting today is basically, what we're going to discuss of the meeting of November 15th. So are you comfortable with that description? I mean, because we're going to basically have the same conversation that we had then, and it's, if it is there a motion to accept the minutes of the whoever was present? Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, it's moved and seconded. Let's accept the minutes. Okay, well, getting to the next interesting part of the conversation is the committee needs to select a chairman and a vice chairman. I was informed of it. So we'll open up the floor for selection of a board chairman.
Vice chairman?
Huh?
Vice chairman?
No, board chairman. Oh. Or the chairman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, not to be out of order, but wouldn't someone other than yourself have to ask for nominations?
I don't know. Interesting, because yeah, I'm just the intern here for right now. It is, because I can't make a motion, I know that. I can't. But who would? Basically, we don't have a chair. You know, I'm an interim chairman.
Well, you're acting chairman.
Yeah, I'm acting chairman of it. It is. What are the rules, Alan, on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I guess as we did before, there was just a motion made suggesting that whoever you'd like to be would be chairman of the board. So I guess it would just be open for a motion for someone to make if someone would like to do that, or if you want to have a couple of different suggestions, you could certainly do that too.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I would move a nomination, the name of Representative Kempnick as chairman of the Legacy Fund Advisory Committee.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, it's moved and seconded. Is there any other nominations? Is there any motions?
Mr. Acting Chairman, I would move that the Secretary cast the unanimous ballot for Keith Kempenich as President of the Legacy Council.
Okay, well, thank you. It was moved and seconded to cast the unanimous ballot. Okay, well, now we got that over with. We got the next item. Go ahead.
We should have a roll call vote.
Okay.
And then also you may want to discuss the potential vice chairman as well.
Okay.
Because we didn't do that the time before and it caused us some issues.
Okay, yeah. Okay, well, we can have a roll call, I guess. Didn't know how formal we needed to be.
Representative Kempinick?
Yes.
Kreit?
Yes.
Senators Dotsenrod?
Yes.
Klein?
Aye.
Ms. Sharp?
Yes.
Mr. Hardmeyer?
Yes.
Mr. Fong?
Yes.
Okay, well, that motion carried then. Okay, well, we heard Mr. Knutson. I think what we need to do is get a have a vice chairman. Is there any nominations?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to nominate Senator Jerry Klein for vice chair of the Legacy Fund Investment Board.
Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, it's moved and seconded to nominate Senator Klein for the vice chairman. Is there any other nominations? Is there any other nominations? Is there any other nominations? Okay, well, we'll have the clerk take the roll then for Senator Jerry Klein as vice chairman of the Legacy Advisory Board.
Representative Kempinick?
Yes.
Representative Kreit?
Yes.
Senators Dotsenrod? Klein?
Aye.
Turn your mic up.
Mrs. Sharp? Ms. Sharp?
Yes.
Mr. Hardmeyer?
Yes.
Mr. Fong?
Yes.
You want to move up here then? Are you comfortable where you're at, hiding behind the pillar? Oh, sure, when they start throwing things at us, huh? Well, we got our board put together. I think what, as we just said earlier, I think the main purpose of this meeting is to have RV Kuhn present their findings and analysis of what we should be looking at as far as how our North Dakota's legacy fund is going to move forward. And it's been, I wanted, you know, and I appreciate you gentlemen from coming in. You gave us some dates, so I think there was quite a bit of interest in trying to get this done before the session ended, and so that's why we're here today. And so I'm if there's any other comments or anything, I think we'll have to call RV Kuhn up to give their, or Darren, did you have something you wanted to bring first and stuff on it? Okay, Darren.
Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, my name is Darren Schultz, and I currently serve as interim CIO at the North Dakota Retirement and Investment Office and State Investment Board. With us today, we have Josh Keevan, Ron Clotter, and John McLaughlin from the investment consulting firm RV Kuhn's, who will be presenting the results of their asset allocation and spending study for the North Dakota Legacy Fund. By way of background, last September, RV Kuhn's was retained to perform an asset allocation and spending study for the Legacy Fund. And last November, Josh, Ron, and John met with the advisory board in a preliminary meeting just to get a better understanding of a range of topics relating to the Legacy Fund, such topics as board governance, the decision-making process for investments and spending, oil and gas revenues, as well as asset allocation. Since November, RIO staff has worked with RV Kuhn's to establish and refine the parameters of the study, namely the identification of asset classes, as well as the candidate portfolios that should be considered for the basis of the study. Unless the board has any questions for me, I'd like to turn it over to Josh, Ron, and John to present the results of their study.
Okay. Thanks, Darren.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, good afternoon. My name is Josh Keevan. I'm a senior consultant with RV Kuhn's and Associates. I'd like to start by thanking you for your time this afternoon and thanking you for the opportunity to present this report to you. This is a very significant decision. It's a very exciting time to be involved in this process, and we're very honored to be here to present this study to you today. So we thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
What we thought we'd do, since we haven't had a chance to introduce ourselves to everybody here yet, just a little bit of backgrounds on ourselves, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I'll start with myself, and our bios are on pages 3 and 4 of this report. I've been with RV Coons for about 13 years, and I serve as a senior consultant. I also serve on our board and our executive committee. Our firm has a lot of experience in working with funds of this type in states like Wyoming, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. And specifically, I've been the lead consultant working with the Wyoming Permanent Funds for about the last 10 years. And so this is a project that was with a fund type that I've had a lot of experience with. I'm going to let my colleagues stand up here and introduce themselves as well.
Good afternoon. My name is Ron Clotter. I'm based in our Chicago office, director of Midwest Consulting for RV Coons. Have about 26 years of experience in the business. In addition to working with Josh and John on this project, we work on several other related projects. My specific focus here was on this project was looking at spending policy options, and as we'll get into that, we'll discuss alternatives there.
My name is John McLaughlin. Pleasure to be here today. I work in the Chicago office of RV Coons and Associates, and prior to that, for close to 3 years, I worked in our Portland headquarters. So much of the data-driven analysis that you see in your broader report, in addition to the summary packet you have in front of you, was produced by me in conjunction with Ron and Josh. In addition, while he's not here today, there was an investment associate in our Chicago office, William Lee, who has a background in consulting at Cambridge and Associates. And he was very instrumental in a lot of the data analysis that you see in front of you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we've passed out two different documents, and the one that we're primarily going to work from today is the PowerPoint presentation. It appears that most of you have that. This is a summary of the bigger report, which is the larger bound document, which reads as more of a text document, but the PowerPoint presentation is essentially a summary of that report. I'm going to start in section one of the report on page 6, just by way of overview and background. One of the things that we would say to you at this point is that this decision, as far as how much of the assets are dedicated or targeted towards each of the different potential asset classes that you can invest in, is the single most important decision that fiduciaries of institutional investment portfolios have in front of them. And there's been a number of studies that are pretty well documented in academia that support this. It's said a lot. You've probably heard somebody else say this before. But we do believe very strongly in that, and that this decision in terms of how the assets are allocated to the various asset classes is going to be much more meaningful and is going to drive the returns and the risk of this portfolio to a much more significant degree than any of the underlying decisions that end up getting made about how it gets implemented. So this is a very important decision. Our primary focus as we went about doing this study was to look at potential different portfolios and recommend to you a portfolio that we believe has the highest odds of success of meeting the objectives of this fund. And we'll talk a little bit about what those objectives are and how we analyzed which portfolios have the best chance of success in terms of meeting those objectives. And we tried to make sure that we looked at that not just in scenarios where everything goes well, but also in a variety of economic scenarios, some of them which are not as optimistic. So it's a robust analysis. If you turn to page 7, this is an outline of some of the key areas of analysis in the report. And the first and the third are actually pretty closely related, so I'm going to speak to them together. One of the important things that we looked at was the revenue inflows and the projection for those revenue flows into the legacy fund. And John's going to spend some more time talking about some of that detail. We'd like to thank the tax commissioner and his office for providing us a lot of very detailed and good information and allowing us to ask questions, and that was very helpful in our process of forecasting that. That is important in the asset allocation decision-making process because there is a fundamental link between the flows in and out of the investment portfolio and the ability to take risk in the capital markets. And to just make it, you know, to simply state it, portfolios that have inflows are better able to take risk than portfolios that have net outflows. And as we think about the legacy fund and where it's at in its life cycle, the analogy that we used at one point in the report is it's a lot like an early stage 401k or 457 plan investor. Some early in their career, they're making positive, you know, deferring part of their income to save that for some point in the future when they're going to need that to supplement their income. But that's a long ways in the future, and there's no significant liquidity needs in the near term. And also there's when the inflows that are coming in are large relative to the size of the assets, that helps supplement that helps the ability to take risk because you've got this natural dollar cost averaging process that's going on. Markets may fall, but you've got positive inflows that are coming in and buying assets at lower prices the next month. And that's much different than a fund, a mature pension fund, for example, that is a net payer of benefits. Because that, if your net cash flow negative and markets fall, you don't have a long time to make it up. The legacy fund is very much in what we call an accumulation phase. It's relatively early in that accumulation phase. And there's a link between where you're at in that life cycle and your ability to take risk. The second bullet is one of the things that we thought was important to analyze in this process was the link between the driver of those revenue flows, which is largely driven by oil prices and production, and the behavior of the investments in the portfolio. And this is kind of a big picture thing that we think is important, but ideally you don't want the same economic factors that are driving sort of the size of those revenue flows to also be influencing your investment portfolio in exactly the same way at exactly the same time. Ideally, you want to have low correlation between those two, so that you know, if for some reason there was a big drop in oil prices, you don't want a big drop in your investment portfolio to happen at exactly the same time. From there, we used fairly standard asset allocation tools to help to identify what we call candidate portfolios, so a range of different asset allocation mixes that we identified that you could choose from among. And then lastly, from there, we took those candidate portfolios and stress-tested them against lots of different market outcomes and different cash flow scenarios to really sort of test which of these does the best job of meeting the goals of the legacy fund. The summary of those goals is on page 8, and this is from the legacy fund investment policy, the green text at the top of the page. And if you'll bear with me, I'll just read it here briefly. The legacy fund was created in part due to the recognition that state revenue from the oil and gas industry will be derived over a finite time frame. The legacy fund defers the recognition of 30% of this revenue for the benefit of future generations. The primary mission of the legacy fund is to preserve the real inflation-adjusted purchasing power of the money deposited into the fund. And there's some really powerful and important concepts that are conveyed in that policy statement, and we've tried to draw them out in the bullets on this page. Two key concepts are a focus on building a corpus for future generations and the focus on preserving purchasing power. The word in the last sentence where you see the word real, that means inflation adjusted. And we'll talk a little bit about what that means in terms of how you have to think about the returns of this fund. Implications for the asset allocation policy. The statements talks about the deferral of income for building wealth for future generations, which implies that current income is not the primary focus of the legacy fund. It also speaks to the goal of creating generational equity in real inflation-adjusted terms, and that implies an emphasis on growth and implies a very long investment time horizon. On page 9, we talk about what is this idea of preserving real purchasing power. What does that mean? What do we need to do that? And there's some basic components to that formula that we've outlined on page 9. Inflation, spending, and expenses. The rate of return that you need to meet that objective is you need a rate of return that is higher than the combination of those three things: inflation, spending, and expenses. So in this example, and this is just a hypothetical example, where if inflation is 2.5% and 3.5% is spent and expenses are 0.6%, in order to provide for the level of spending and to preserve the real inflation-adjusted purchasing power of the money that's been invested, in this example, you need a return of 6.6, and that's a nominal return. You'll see in our report there's a few places where we refer to nominal versus real. This is nominal, 6.6. The real return that's needed is 3.1%. So we need a real return, so our return after the 2.5% inflation of the 3.5 plus the 0.6. Or, I'm sorry, a 4.1% return. And the idea is, inflation causes, the things that that this fund is going to pay for in the future are going to cost more than they cost today. So that's the idea of preserving the ability of this fund to purchase those things in real terms. And so the required rate of return is a variable, is a function of these variables. What does this mean for investment policy? As an extreme example, with the way that we understand the policies around the legacy fund, a portfolio that's 100% in fixed income, where almost all of the return is derived from the income, is almost by definition not going to meet that goal of preserving real purchasing power. Income is automatic, not in the next 4.5 years, but beyond that, beyond June 30th, 2017, income will automatically be swept out at the end of each biennium. So if all of the return is income, there's nothing left to keep up with inflation. And so that's a pretty important implication for investment policy. And as an extension of that, if the goal is to preserve real purchasing power, there's a price to being too conservative, and we'll try to quantify that in some of the analysis that we'll show you. Spending is a difficult thing to forecast here, because beyond the income, there's an ability to also take up to 15% of the value of the corpus during each biennium. And so spending becomes sort of this unknowable part of that equation, and that does add some complexity to the asset allocation. But we think we've got some good practical guides for how to think about that in the context of making decisions.
Well, we're having a little, Josh, and I'm just going to interject here, and that is an issue, and it does make it a little, because it's every 2 years that this assembly gets together, and so you mm-hmm. can't really tell what's going to happen. We know what's going to happen in the 4 years, and I think we assume that what we know today is what we'll go forward with on that. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's hard to predict into the future, so I think we'll probably, in committee, if you got any other comments on that issue, and we'll get into it deeper when you start explaining out some of that. Yeah. But I think the spending part of this is probably not the biggest issue today. Mm-hmm. It's more of trying to get what we can get at a percentage point. And like I said, I know you got other stuff going forward here and stuff on it. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that we do recommend is that this decision on asset allocation is a best practice. We do recommend that clients revisit this every 3 to 4 years or so. And our thinking behind that time frame is this is a very long-term decision, so it's not one that you want to be revisiting every year necessarily. But 3 to 4 years is, in our experience, a sufficiently long enough period of time that valuation levels in the markets may have changed significantly, or general economic conditions may have changed significantly. So the good news as it relates to the unknowable part of this is that there is a lot more certainty over the next 4.5 years, and we would actually recommend that you revisit this decision before we get to that point in time where, as we describe it, you're in an accumulation phase now, and then at the point in time where spending starts, you'll enter what we call a permanent phase. So, are there any other questions that I can answer on the overview?
Yep. Thank you. So you mentioned early on that this is like the beginning of a 457 plan or 401k, and so where there's no expected spending. And so when I look at your example, and even as we think about asset allocation today, knowing that there's no spending coming for, you know, 4 or 5 years, maybe longer, is it appropriate then in your formula here that you even consider the expected spending rate?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hardmire, we believe it is because even though we're focused on the first 4.5 years, we know that they're spending in the future, and this is a very long-term decision. So as it relates to the long-term decision, we do think it's appropriate to consider that. Even though, you know, we do recommend that there be a revisiting of the asset allocation decision before we hit 2017, but you don't want to make a long-term, you don't want to make an asset allocation decision today that you're going to have to turn around and completely change to a real significant degree in a period of time that's as short as 3 to 4 years. It's too short a period of time to make these long-term investments in the equity markets in particular.
So. One comment. In terms of the logistics.
Just say your name so we get.
Sure. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Ron Clotter. Mr. Hardmire, excellent question. In terms of the logistics of how we built the report, when we started, we quickly centered on having two phases to the modeling, which tie into the point you were making that on a certain date, income, at least income, starts being withdrawn. So when we use the terms accumulation phase and permanent phase, those actually align to two discrete pieces of the modeling we did. So that's how we incorporated that date and the change in spending.
Mr. Chairman, at this time I'm going to turn it over to my colleague John McLaughlin, who's going to talk about the revenue projections.
Mr. Chairman, this is John McLaughlin, as Josh mentioned. So the section I was going to cover within the report is the second section, and it begins on page 11 with the content beginning on page 12. So as Josh noted, one of the key inputs to the modeling process was the assumption of what cash flows were coming into the fund during this accumulation phase, and then in the permanent phase that Ron referenced, cash flows coming in as well as the different spending policies that we used. And to get a good handle on an accurate forecast, we worked with the state tax commissioner, which was very generous with their time. We hosted a conference call to get a handle on the average barrels of production per day, how many days are in a month for a production cycle, assumptions around oil spot prices both currently as well as into the future through fiscal year 2016, and then what an effective tax rate is currently. And from that, if I could have everyone focus on the middle of the revenue forecast detail page, as you can see there, that created a nice little equation. And from that, you multiply each of those variables, and you have just below that the total monthly revenue from current production. And from there, to look at the cash flows that go into the legacy fund, We first took out the assumed tribal monthly distribution, which over time through the 2013-2016 fiscal period is assumed to increase over time with the expectation that production levels on tribal lands would increase. And from there, we took that and multiplied times 30% to get a baseline assumption for monthly cash flows that would be coming into the legacy fund during the accumulation phase. From here, we wanted to have that as a solid baseline to begin our analysis. But we also wanted to recognize, to Josh's earlier point, that an important what-if analysis is what if production values fall. So we assumed in an adverse case scenario that they fell 50%. Secondarily, we wanted to assume, you know, what would happen if oil prices halved. So across each of those periods that we looked at, we assumed that spot prices decreased by half. And then again, with the expectation that if you've got a period where production levels are low and spot prices are low relative to that baseline, there is a safe assumption that there would be some tax holidays. So we assume that the effective tax rate on oil production fell from 10.8% to 9%. So from there, for the asset allocation modeling, that created a good baseline scenario, but also, as importantly, an adverse case scenario, as we've outlined here on page 12. Going forward to page 13, the next three slides, so pages 13, 14, and 15, they just take what I describe and chart that graphically. So on page 13, what you have here is the assumption for oil production with the blue line representing that base case I discussed, with the red line representing that adverse case. And again, on page 14, as you can see here, we've got the base case represented by blue. So oil beginning at 70, then going to 75, and then 80. And the adverse case, as I mentioned, representing each of those values reduced by 50%. And with page 15, what we see here is the interaction of those two in addition to those other variables. So what we have here is the blue line representing during this accumulation phase what the assumption for revenues into the legacy fund would look like. And again, the red line representing that very adverse case scenario. As you can see, directionally relative to the blue line, it represents what we believe is a pretty pessimistic scenario. And again, I'll finish up before I turn things back over to Josh on page 16. So that analysis brought us with a good baseline and adverse case scenario for this accumulation phase. But what we also wanted to look at was the cash flows coming into the fund as well as out of the fund during the permanent phase that Ron referenced. And here what we did to make what we believe is a pretty conservative assumption, we took the ending value for both the baseline and the adverse case scenario and assumed that was just flat into the future, so over that permanent phase. So for the baseline, that represents $65.8 million in revenue per month in the legacy fund. And in that adverse case scenario, $11.8 million, so quite a significant drop off. And from there, there are three main points to infer and draw from this section of the analysis. Number one, and these are outlined in the third bullet on page 16, liquidity requirements are virtually non-existent during the accumulation phase. Secondarily, regular cash inflows creates a natural dollar cost averaging process for the fund. And finally, and this point is important, the inflows are very large relative to the current size of the fund and assets. Before I turn things back over to Josh, I'll see if there's any questions about the assumption that went into this.
Any questions? Representative Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I noticed on page 13, mm-hmm. production is, you know, flat over the from January 13 to July 15. Really no, you know, increase in production. And, you know, we're hearing figures, you know, that we're going to see a continued, you know, increase in barrels of production for, you know, probably the next 4, 5, 6 years. So you didn't base that at all into the formula, just using a flat prediction, is that?
We use the best available data that we have was provided by the State Tax Commissioner, but I'll let Josh.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Craig, these assumptions may be on the conservative side. I think, at, you know, one thing we'd say about that is that's probably okay in an analysis like this. Things may end up being better than this. The base case assumption is a very robust stream of cash flows into the fund. And if we assumed that they were even better than that, the resulting analysis that you take away from that would be the same. And so these we acknowledge these may in hindsight be conservative assumptions, but we don't believe that would change the analysis if we assumed that they were even higher than this. More importantly, we wanted to really run a stress test, more of a stress case scenario where, and you know, it would be where there's something happens, there's some significant drop off in prices and production. We want to ask ourselves, what does this look like if things don't go as well as they are currently? And that, so to answer your question, you know, these may end up being conservative estimates, but we don't think it alters the analysis.
Mr. Fong.
Kevens and Representative Kreit, I believe that the numbers are based on our forecast for 2013-15, which is embedded in the budget. So that is oil production basically topping out at 850,000 barrels a day. You know, that is potentially a conservative forecast, but it's aligned with what I'm saying is our budget forecast for 2013-15.
Well, and I think committee, the thing is the end result of what, you know, because we're going forward, and I think the end result, though, is like what you said, Josh, is that that's really what the number is more we're looking at the return part of this, and if it keeps increasing, it's just going to be a bigger number. It shouldn't change what percent of return or what we're going to base our decisions on anyways of what that number is that's being invested. Shouldn't really change that per se, should it?
Mr. Chairman, if the inflows were larger, it would actually support an even higher degree of risk taking, but ultimately we don't think that it significantly affects the decision that you have in front of you in terms of the asset allocation.
Okay, any other Representative Craig?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Josh, we're going to review the plan, like you say, in 4 years, you know, on your behalf, it looks better if we estimate low and if things are way higher, and you can say, well, you know, you really did a good job.
That's customer service 101 is under promise, over deliver. Yeah.
Bet low and hope high.
Go ahead. Are there any other questions? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'd like to actually turn now to Section 3 in the analysis. I'm going to go to page 19. I mentioned we analyzed the correlation of the sort of the linkage between the drivers of the revenue, which is largely oil production and prices, and the asset class returns themselves. And the way that we did this was we measured the, going back over time, the change in the spot price of West Texas Intermediate crude oil, and we looked at each, how that changed as a percentage in every month of history, and how that change correlated to the returns experienced in these different asset classes. And the way that you read a table like this with the correlation statistics is anywhere the range is from -1 to +1. +1 means that those two things are perfectly correlated with each other. They always move in the same direction and the same magnitude. -1 would be the exact opposite. It would tell you that there's actually an inverse correlation. If something goes one way, the other goes exactly the opposite way in the same magnitude. And 0 would tell you that there's just no discernible pattern. There's really no relationship here. And this is an important concept in asset allocation as it relates to building a portfolio of assets that aren't perfectly correlated to each other and have some diversification properties. But here it's also important in terms of understanding the correlation to the price of oil, which is a dominant driver of the revenue flows. And so if you focus on that farmost left column on this table under crude oil, this is just a snapshot in time. So this is just looking at correlations over about the last 10 years. And you'll see that to equities, both U.S. and international, the correlation has been moderately positive, 0.45 and 0.48, indicating there's been some relationship, but it hasn't been necessarily a real strong relationship. It's actually been negative between fixed income and oil, which tends to make sense. Fixed income tends to do better in deflationary. It's your protection against deflation, whereas oil tends to be more of an inflationary asset. We did look at some subsets of the different markets, and even though we didn't model all of these as their own discrete asset class in the modeling, we think that some of this may have useful implications for the implementation phase in terms of what types of fixed income get used in the portfolio. Emerging markets debt is one part of that market that actually exhibits very low correlations to oil. Conversely, bank loans, which tend to have floating rates of interest, tend to have higher correlations to oil, which also makes sense if you think about the way that bank loans tend to be floating rate instruments that go up, the interest ratchets up when interest rates rise. And you can see with some of the additional investments here, TIPS, which are inflation-protected treasury securities, core real estate, and timber, also relatively low correlations to oil. On page 20, we looked at this over different periods of time, because the previous page was just a snapshot. And one of the problems with snapshots is they tend to be very endpoint sensitive, and correlations are not static. They don't always stay exactly the same. They move around. And so what we've shown you here is for the different equity markets, both U.S. and international, what rolling three-year correlations have been. And you can see that the relationship between equities and oil is actually somewhat volatile. It's been higher recently. So on the far right-hand side of the page, you can see we've been in a period where the correlation between oil prices and stock market performance has been higher. And part of that is driven by the fact that energy as a sector has been growing in the U.S. and has been one of the stronger drivers of economic performance. You can look at past periods of time, like the 80s and 90s, where that was lower, where the stock market was doing well, but energy wasn't as big a part of the driving force behind the economic growth during those times periods of time. And so one of the takeaways we have here is that the correlation can be high. Both equities and oil tend to be somewhat economically sensitive, and so it's a little bit of a caution against having too much in equities. And it's why in our analysis we ultimately don't recommend the most aggressive portfolios that we looked at. Okay. On page 21, we look at some of the different fixed income markets. And there's a typo on this page. If you'd please cross out broad international equity and type in or write in EMD or emerging markets debt, that is what that dotted blue line represents. And you can see, conversely, with fixed income, one of the nice things about fixed income is that the correlations to oil tend to be more, there is some volatility, but if you look at where they are on the scale, they are more consistently low correlations between oil and fixed income, although there's certain parts of the fixed income market that are more and less correlated to this. The challenge with fixed income is obviously the low level of returns. It makes it difficult to meet the objectives if you have too much, but to some degree there's some benefit here, and this is one of the primary benefits that we see. In terms of the asset classes that we considered for the study, we did look to the within the assets in the insurance investment pool overseen by the State Investment Board, which is where the legacy fund resides, which asset classes are available for use by the legacy fund. And those the asset classes that we've listed here are domestic equity, both large and small, international equity, fixed income, diversified real assets, which you'll see we've combined these three into a single asset class assumption. That includes TIPS, infrastructure, and timber investments, and lastly, core real estate. One of the recommendations that we did put in our report is our understanding is that the assets of the legacy fund currently cannot be pooled with the assets of other funds. And if there is a way to pool those, we would recommend doing so. It will just save you on fees, and you're likely to get some efficiencies of scale if you can commingle the assets together within that state insurance investment pool. On page 23, you see our forward-looking capital markets assumptions for each of these asset classes. These are our proprietary assumptions. One of the appendix of the larger report was our annual white paper that we produce that explains our process that we go through every year to develop these assumptions. We do not assume that the future is going to look exactly like the past. We take a very detailed look at where current valuations levels are. We study the history of capital markets in terms of the relationships of asset classes to each other, but that all feeds into our own forward-looking forecast over the long term, which we define as 10-plus years, of both the return on the left, the middle column here, and also the risk associated with each asset class. And the risk is defined here as the standard deviation, which is essentially the volatility of the returns. So just to give you a simple example of how the math works, we assume that on average, the broad U.S. equity market, which includes both large and small cap, is going to return 7.9%, but that's just the expected average. There's a range around that, and it's a volatile asset class, and the volatility is quantified as that 18%. So if you think about your bell-shaped curve, your normal distribution, 7.9 is in the middle. Within any 12-month period, we expect it to be plus or minus the 18, and that gives you kind of the plus or minus one standard deviation, or approximately that. What that means is approximately two-thirds of the time, that's what you should expect. It's going to be 7.9 plus or minus 18, and then about 95% of the time it should be plus or minus that twice, so 18, essentially 36 plus or minus. And so it gives you a sense of not just what do we expect, but how wide's the potential variability in that in any one year. If you turn to page 25, so we've talked about the inputs. We've got the expected return, the expected risk, the expected correlation. This goes into the optimization model, which essentially is a tool that looks at all of the different ways that you can combine the asset classes together, and it tells you, it basically helps you develop what we call an efficient frontier, which is essentially it solves for, at each level of expected return, how do you get that return with the least amount of risk? That's essentially what we're trying to do here. And the output from that model is essentially portfolios 1 through 10. You can see what that looks like graphically, that portfolio 1 through 10 or that efficient frontier on the next page, page 26. It's a little easier to conceptualize this graphically. We're measuring return on the left, risk across the bottom. So ideally you want a portfolio on this page that's as far up and to the left as we can possibly get it. But that sort of but the best that you can do given the forecast and the constraints that we've used in our modeling at every level of given expected return is that blue line. And so that's how we build these model these candidate portfolios, and that's what you see there. We've actually picked out specific portfolios off of that line, essentially at different levels of equity exposure, and you can see that's how we've labeled them. So at the conservative end, 30% equity, at the most aggressive end, 75% equity, and then in the middle, a little bit more granular detail between 45 and 60% equity. And you can see the detail of those portfolios on the previous page in terms of what their composition is, in terms of what their expected return and their expected risk is. This is the first step in the process. This is a very helpful tool to help identify potential portfolios that you might choose amongst. It's not very helpful at making decisions, though. It's because, I mean, these numbers, you know, you see the expected returns range from 5.4 to 7.5. It's hard to translate that into decision making.
Well, Josh, and it, you know, and that, but I think it is in a lot of ways, you know, and it depends on, we've had this, conversation before, is how much, you know, the risk involved versus what your return, you're hitting this, and it gives a good example of what kind of you're looking at, and what, and that's, I think, going to be one of the, that's the decision that we got to, what we're going to try to come up with here, is that, and I think this is helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The point of this is to really identify the choices, but we're gonna run these choices through some different scenarios to help you understand what we think the range of outcomes is in real dollar outcomes. One of the things that is obvious, but I'll say it anyways, is there isn't more return without more risk. And the relationship here we believe in is the upward sloping efficient frontier, and essentially more return is achieved by taking more risk. So, page 27, we start to introduce the additional modeling that we've done to really sort of stress test and look at potential outcomes for these different candidate portfolios. And the technical term is Monte Carlo simulation. But essentially what we're trying to do is we're trying to really stress test this and help answer the question. Really, there's really two things that this is helpful for. The first is that we can incorporate the cash flows. So those revenue projections that John spoke about, both the base case and the adverse case, we can actually incorporate those into the analysis to help see what the future path of values are. The other thing that this is helpful for is it's helpful for not just seeing, okay, we expect the return of this one to be 6.5, but it's helpful for seeing what the range of potential outcomes is. What the Monte Carlo does is it's essentially a random number generator that takes the properties of these portfolios and runs them through 10,000 different scenarios that are generated, and it incorporates into that some variability around what inflation might be, and it incorporates into that the variability of what the different investment outcomes might be, and it allows us to add the cash flows into that to evaluate the range of what could happen in terms of the value of the legacy funds portfolio. It's also helpful because there's some weaknesses of the asset allocation tool. I talked about the normally distributed sort of return example, but that's one of the common and well-known weaknesses of the mean variance or the asset allocation tool that I just described, is that in real life, things aren't nice and evenly distributed. You've probably heard somebody talk about black swans or left tail events. Essentially what that refers to is that returns there tends to be on sort of the left-hand side of that distribution, there tends to be a fatter tail, or another way to think about that is sort of the outsized negative events tend to happen actually more frequently than a lot of the science that's been used to build portfolios would have suggested historically. And so in terms of how we've built this model, we've assumed a distribution that looks a lot more like the real world than the nice normal bell-shaped curve. And so that's an important point. We did three on page 28. We've outlined really sort of the three different ways that we looked at this. First of all, we focused, as Ron mentioned earlier, we focused first on the accumulation phase modeling. So that's just looking at the next 4.5 years. With the projected cash flows and that time period, and we'll show you those results. We also looked at it over the next 20 years, incorporating both that first 4.5 years where all the flows are positive, but also the rest of the 20 years beyond that where spending could also be introduced. And we used three different spending models just to kind of show what different spending levels do to the analysis. One of them that we, and Ron's going to talk a little bit about what we did there in terms of building those three different spending policies. And then the last thing that we did was we looked at the permanent phase without any cash flows coming in. And the reason we did that is we thought it was important to really look at how do the investments of these portfolios do in terms of meeting the objective, because the objective is stated as preserving the real purchasing power of the money deposited into the fund. So if you just look at the starting investments and you assume different spending out into the future, that was helpful for looking at which of these does the best job for really doing that, achieving that, or giving you the best odds of success as it relates to that goal of preserving real purchasing power. So starting on the accumulation phase on page 30, when we ran this through the Monte Carlo simulation over the next 4.5 years, what you see here is the range of returns that came out of that analysis. So across the top you see 30, the candidate portfolios 30, 45, 50, and out to 75% in equities. But then you also see across the left percentiles. And that's essentially the range of outcomes that came out of this analysis. And the way that you want to the way that you read this is, I'd start with the 50th percentile. That is sort of the 10,000 scenarios that were run for each of these portfolios. That's the return that's right in the middle of those 10,000. If you look at the fifth percentile, that means that 95% of them were better than that. So that's sort of out on that left tail, and represents, you know, essentially bad investment markets over the next 4.5 years. Conversely, on the bottom half of this table, out to the 75th, 90th, and 95th percentile, that gives you a sense for the distribution, if we have better investment markets, what the returns would be for these different mixes. And so it's helpful for not just looking at, well, we expect the expected return is 6.5%, but you can actually see here that you know, on the downside, for the 60% equity portfolio, for example, the return would actually be an annualized loss of 5%. That's possible using this simulation model. And if you go out to 75%, the downside gets worse, down 7.4. So there's a trade-off here between expected returns and downside possibilities. But what's even more helpful is when you build in those cash flows, and we do that on page 31. So here we're using those same return distributions, but building in this case, the base case cash flows over the next 4.5 years. And this gives you actual dollars. This gives you, okay, what is the market value of the portfolio at June 30th, 2017? And if you look at the, just across at the 50th percentile, it starts at, for the 30% equity portfolio, about $4 billion. And all the way out to the right at 75% equity, it's about 4.25. So you would expect, as you have more equity, more risk in the portfolio, you'd expect the outcomes to be higher at the 50th percentile. If you look up at the fifth percentile, it's the opposite. At the more conservative portfolio, so this is the scenario where essentially we have bad capital markets over the next 4.5 years. It's about $3.3 billion on the 30% equity portfolio. And as you go to the right, it's a little bit lower. We would point out, though, that it's not, as you go to the right, it's not, there's not a significant difference here across the fifth percentile. There's not a significant difference across the 50th percentile. And part of what's driving that is the cash flows are large relative to the size of the asset. So the cash flows are the dominant driver of the values. And that does, as you can see, you know, at some of these worst investment outcomes, it's really where you see that sort of natural dollar cost averaging working to your advantage. If you do have losses at some point, you know, you've got new money coming in, and that can work to your advantage.
One of the things is that you're, if you go into these, like the fifth percentile, is your dollars probably, you got less purchasing power going across it too, and you know, mm-hmm. what dollars are going in real, you know, like in today's dollars versus future dollars and stuff on it. But that's part of the yeah. reason we're trying to figure out. We don't want to yeah. want to stay out of that.
So this is, and then on page 32, this is with the adverse case scenario, which is a very pessimistic scenario for the revenue flows. And what we'd point out here is that the numbers are lower, but the relationships are essentially the same. As you look at the relationships here, there's not a lot of difference. The basic story or takeaways from this are the same. The numbers are just lower.
And this is assuming a 50% drop-off?
Correct.
Okay.
Section 4 is the spending policy, the spending models that we built into this. So moving beyond the accumulation phase into some of the more longer-term thinking about this once you start to introduce spending, and Ron is going to step up and cover that.
Okay. Thank you, Josh.
That was a lot of data, so everyone can take a deep breath.
Yeah.
That's a whole lot to absorb. We appreciate your patience. The spending discussion, I think you'll find very interesting, because you're in a fairly unique situation in that you're not spending the assets now. You have a date where you will start taking income automatically, and at that same date you'll have some spending options. So the useful analysis now is to look at different asset allocation mixes that you can consider today and what the implications may be for long-term spending. So I think you'll find some of this data fairly useful. As we mentioned throughout, we've developed the analysis using two phases, the accumulation phase and the permanent phase. On page 34, this is kind of the happy part of the presentation, in that for the next 4.5 years, given the amount of money coming in, given the scenarios that we forecasted as possible asset allocation options, we don't see any scenario you won't have more money 4.5 years from now than you have now. So this is the part where you can pop open the bottle of champagne. So we spent most of our time looking at what happens once that permanent phase goes into effect. And if you turn to page 35, it's useful to look at what are the implications of the what we call the permanent phase. First is the income will start to be withdrawn every biennium, as you know. Second, the legislature may, subject to the terms defined in the legislation, take an additional amount up to 15% of the market value every biennium. So what we did in the modeling, this may be obvious, but it's important to remember, because when we're doing modeling now, we don't know what the income is going to be in 2017. So you have to make some assumption on what to use for annual income. And we assumed a 3% annual income disbursement as a number for an income assumption looking forward. As you get closer to 2017, you'll have a much better idea what the actual income is going to be, and that's one of the reasons we have mentioned on a couple times that we would recommend that you update this as you get closer to that date. On page 36, we actually tested three different spending scenarios, and I'll explain what each of them are there, because they're fairly straightforward. The first is if you spend only income. So the requirement is that income is spent. Let's say that you spent just income. And again, we modeled that at 3% per year. The second is more in line with the traditional endowment foundation payout ratio, which is 5% a year. Most foundations actually, due to the IRS code, pay out 5% a year. So if you wanted to say, well, what if we spent something in line with the average foundation? For that proxy, we used 5% a year. The third thing we tested was taking out the maximum amount, which we modeled. We basically took the 15% biennium, split it in half, and added on the income. And that's where the 10.5% comes in. And what's useful now is to take each of those scenarios and look at the probability of basically meeting your mission, protecting the corpus of the assets with each of those different spending scenarios. If you turn to 37, this goes back to some of the math that Josh covered earlier and what we're trying to accomplish in terms of protecting the purchasing power of the assets. So a 5% total spending target, if you keep that same inflation assumption of 2.5%, and let's say expenses were 50 basis points, That adds up to 8% a year. And sort of to tie all these pieces together, if you remember those portfolios on the asset allocation, that frontier line, none of them had an expected return of 8%. They were all lower than 8%. So the point of this is to get across that spending 5% is a fairly high a hurdle in terms of an expected return for the long-term return of the portfolio. To do that, you'd have to look at what we would envision as more of an endowment-like investment structure, which means meaningful investment in equity-oriented investments probably would include some alternative investments. So then at the far extreme, one question you might have is there any scenario where we could spend the maximum to protect the corpus? And the answer is no. Given the asset allocation parameters we've outlined, and we show the math behind that, that to take out the maximum and to stay within what we think would be reasonable asset allocation targets, the corpus or the core of the assets would be impacted by that.
So in other words, you're saying you'd have to do better than 8% or wouldn't even that protect? If you were, say, the legislature did access the 15, you'd have to go higher than the 8% then.
Right. If you had the maximum spending, if the legislature took the maximum spending, none of the portfolios we've looked at in that range on the portfolio would achieve a high enough return over time to protect the corpus.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, go ahead, Ron.
No, thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman. The next two pages are fairly interesting because here we're looking at the same sort of simulation analysis that Josh mentioned on the asset side to see what would happen with different spending scenarios. And I think probably the easiest thing, because there's a lot of text on page 38, is to walk you through an example on page 39. And I'll explain what this page is showing. So this chart is the probability of meeting your return targets, and these are real return targets. So these are taking into account inflation with different equity mixes. So let's use an example. If you look at the target 3% column, so that's the targeted spending, and 3%, as I mentioned earlier, equates with what if we spent just income. Then you look at that 55% equity, and you go across and you'll see 57% probability. That means there's a greater than 50% chance that you protect the real purchasing power of the assets if you spent 3% and you invested in this portfolio that's 55% equity. So obviously today this is not front and center on your mind. Today the goal is to pick an asset mix. But this is helpful at looking long-term at what different asset mixes, what the implications are to meeting different spending targets. And one way to think of it is, as you look forward, there are some asset mixes that fit well with some spending targets. In other words, where you see a number that's 50-60%, that's a reasonable balance. Okay, if that spending target with that asset mix is a reasonable objective for us. If it gets to 80-90%, then it's very likely. But when you start seeing numbers in the 10%, 20%, what that's telling you is the spending level is very aggressive for that asset mix. And that's the way to read this page.
Go, Mr. Fong.
Just so I'm clear, page 39, the targets, they do not include inflation, correct?
The targets do not include inflation. Okay.
So that's taken out of the mix.
Right.
So that's just spending in order to preserve our corpus.
That's correct.
Okay.
And then the reason, for example, you might say, well, why doesn't the 30% equity have 100% chance of meeting the target? That's because this is the probabilities are real. They do include inflation. The target percentages do not.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, we'll have Josh come up to summarize our conclusion and then take any other questions the group might have.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, thank you for your patience. I promise we're close to the end here. I'm going to go back to page 42, and we'll start to wrap up our conclusions here. And in terms of thinking about a recommendation, you know, we go back to the primary mission of the Legacy Fund. We've talked about it a lot today, and that's to preserve the real inflation-adjusted purchasing power of the monies deposited into the fund. The real, and we've talked about this as well, the challenging aspect of that is, while many of the variables are unknown, one of the unknown variables that makes it difficult to think about that from an asset allocation perspective is the spending, because the spending is likely to not be the same every biennium, and we have not attempted to forecast what that will look like necessarily, because we don't think we can. But we do think that we can offer some practical guidance in terms of how to think about that as it relates to making asset allocation decisions. And that's the third, or the second bullet on this page, is to really, we think it would be most effective to really think about this in line with the traditional endowment model, where spending tends to be in the neighborhood of 4 to 5% per year. Some foundations have to spend 5% by law. Where there's flexibility to lower it, we've seen a lot of them lower it from 5 to 4 because of some of the probability data that Ron showed you. Basically, a low return environment makes 5% a challenge. And the reasons that we think this is a practical and appropriate way to think about this in terms of asset allocation decision making is, number one, assuming a higher level of spending really doesn't do you any good, because it would push you to more aggressive equity mixes that would still have very low odds of preserving the corpus. And so we think that that's an impractical way to think about this from asset allocation perspectives. Conversely, there's risk in assuming that spending's only going to be the income, because that could lead you to feeling safe about portfolios that are too conservative. And if spending does end up being something more than that, then those more conservative portfolios will have lower odds of achieving the mission of the fund, which is to preserve the real purchasing power. And so our recommendation on page 43 is to really focus in on those portfolios in between the 50 to 60% in equities. And there were three candidate portfolios in that range, 50, 55, and 60. We've summarized our rationale for that recommendation. It's you know, the stated purpose of the Legacy Fund really speaks to long-term growth and preservation of real purchasing power. We believe that is best supported by portfolios that have at least that level of equity exposure. You've got, over the next 4.5 years, back to my analogy of the early stage 401k, 457 plan investor, by virtue of the fact that you've got these positive cash flows, it really supports an ability to take a higher level of risk. You will eventually enter the permanent phase, and as we discussed earlier, we would caution against taking an extremely aggressive position for a short period of time only to reel that back. You know, what you decide here as a long-term portfolio should, you know, changes to that in the future should really be more evolutionary as you go through time. If you want to go back to page 25 of the report, that might be a useful page, because it's actually got the details on those asset allocation mixes. As I mentioned, somewhere in between that 50 to 60% equities, you can see what the composition of those is. All of them have 5% in core real estate. That's a diversifying asset class that we allowed the model to choose up to 5%. And the model likes it as a diversifying asset class and chose it across the board. And same with diversified real assets, which is, again, a mix of TIPS, infrastructure, and timber investments. We believe that diversification is important in terms of the exposure to some asset classes that will do well in an environment where inflation's higher, but being careful about not investing in real assets that are going to be tightly correlated to the price of oil. And the model likes that at 10%, really all the way across the board. The differences in those three portfolios is really the mix between stocks and bonds. 50% equity has 35% in bonds, 55% equity has 30% in bonds, and 60% equity has 25% in bonds. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes our formal remarks as in regards to this report. We thank you for your time, and we'd be happy to answer questions and further discussion.
Okay. Well, committee, I think we've, you know, and bringing some of the new members up to speed, I think this is kind of what has been, what we've probably been discussing here in the last year is kind of the mix of what and what we want to look for a return. And I think it's been laid out here fairly well of what we're looking at. I think, Josh, you know, in committee, you know, you've got the, on page 25 is basically kind of the core of what we're going to be looking at and stuff on it. And you kind of walked it through here on it to us. But when you get into, like, the model of, you know, like diversified real assets and stuff on it, mm-hmm. you know, and we've seen how you came up and what other, you know, any other raw material or anything, you know, any type of that comes into place in that, you know, as far as, you know, I don't want to get into specifics, mm-hmm. But you use timber as an example and stuff on mm-hmm. it. And is that just one of the components of that, or is that a broad statement when you say is, because it's kind of a raw material, where it seems mm-hmm. to be close to oil, you know, because that's yeah. a raw material too and stuff on it. And do you want to explain that just a little deeper in the diversified
sure.
assets and stuff on it?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in putting this model together, we really focused on the asset classes that are currently tools that are being used within the insurance investment pool.
Okay.
And for modeling, for building the return and risk assumptions, we assume just a naive one-third to each of those. But we would, you know, suggest that, you know, the actual implementation may look different than that. There's another level of decision-making in the implementation
yep.
That isn't as specific as this decision, which is the target for this area of diversified real assets.
Yeah, because you know, committee, basically what we got to, you know, our concentration basically is going to be to the return part of where, you know, and that's basically down halfway the expected returns of what is what we're concentrating, and I'm assuming that's what you expect too, is when you got that in there, and that's, we've been discussing that. You know, I think you've got it laid out very well. Is there any comments or questions? Representative Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And could you go into a little more in depth on what your broad international equities, what you're looking at there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Craig, for modeling purposes, we've assumed the broad markets outside the non-U.S., which includes the developed markets, which is primarily Western Europe and Japan, as well as the emerging markets. If you look at the broad indexes that represent that part of the market, developed is roughly 75% of that, and the emerging markets are roughly 25% of that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and the 0.6% expenses on a fund that gets to be $1 billion or more, that's quite a bit of money. Is that based on some historical averages, or are you putting some state agency expense in there, or where does that 0.6% come from?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dotson-Rodd, that's purely an example, so that's not based on anything related to the legacy fund. That was an example to help make the point of how we need to think about building real returns. Your returns, your expenses may very likely be much lower than that.
So I think the next, did you have a question?
Okay, Mr.
Well, maybe this is where you're going, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering what the expected decision point is here today we're striving for, and then I had a follow-up question, depending on how you answered that.
Well, you know, I think for the current member, or the members that were here, we've probably, you know, this is probably some, I think it lays it out better than what we've had in the past. I think, you know, I think our decision wouldn't take a long time to make. I don't know if people want to, you know, if the committee wants to discuss some, you know, I guess that's up to the committee of, you know, I'd like to see kind of a direction here by the end of the day here that we leave with this. Because I don't think it's, you know, we've got one, we're on, what we're currently doing is all fixed income. And so, you know, we know where that's at and stuff on it. And I think, you know, being, I think there's people, what I've heard anyways, I'd like to see it doing a little better than that. And I think we've seen that here today. And I don't know what the rest of the committee, if you understand it well enough to make a decision on that. But I think what I was going to bring up too, though, is I think we need a motion to accept the report too, is what I think we need that too. We do. Don't we? If we're going to use it as a guide.
That'd be a good idea.
It is.
I move approval of the report that has been provided by R. V. Coons and Associates.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. We can do that on a voice vote, can't we? All members in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All against? Okay, the report's accepted. Now, we can, you know, I don't know, Josh, I think we understand, I think the bottom part of this chart is what our main concern is on this. I think that you've laid this out very well. It's easy to understand. I think, you know, our preview has been to try to get, you know, because we don't do the direct investing. Mm-hmm. When we're in the session, we can do whatever we want, basically. When we're out of session, we got to do with what the decisions we make. But I think it's very well laid out, and you gave us a number of options to talk about. One of the questions I do have, you know, and we use on the, you know, like the probabilities of, you know, we get into these 45-50%, 55% equities, and that's, mm-hmm. you know, in the past that's been one of the hang of doing equities and stuff on it. And, you know, in a defensive investing, you know, and stuff is, you know, what I guess the question becomes, you know, you look at where equities are at today, you know, they've had a good run, you know, and mm-hmm. stuff on a defensive type of scenario, you know, and stuff. What, you know, I mean, you'd lower the risk, obviously, going into it. Mm-hmm. But I was just, that's what gets, you know, when you got to have a personal view of, I mean, not you, but I mean every member on this committee, you know, has got a view of something, and that's what it gets, get over a comfortable you know, a comfortable level there and stuff on it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you ask a really good question. We would encourage, you know, you to really try to separate long-term policy decisions from the implementation decisions. The long-term policy decision is important, but just because you approve a target of 55% equity does not mean that the right implementation approach is to go out and buy all of that tomorrow. And so there's another level of decision-making as it relates to implementation. And you've got the ability with the cash flows that are coming in to use that to your advantage to really sort of average into the long-term target. And so there's probably another level of decision making about how to do that most prudently, and so that's why I suggest sort of that separation of long term policy versus sort of current market dynamics and how it's implemented. And I would just add as another piece of perspective, you know, we've recommended this range from 50% to 60%. Probably less important than which one of these you choose is that you choose one of them and begin that process to move towards them. So that's just a piece. So we would agree with your comments as it relates to that.
Truthfully, that's what, you know, that's, you know, because that's basically what you need to hear is what, yeah. You know, and I mean, it's, and it does get to be a, because it is a long range fund, you know, and truthfully, it's for the next generation.
Absolutely.
We've got our issues presently and they're being dealt with. This is really is for the next generation, and it's stuff that we do, you know, in the what we're doing today and stuff on it. I think it's the stability of the state. It kind of hinges on what we do here with this moving forward, and that's one of the things that, you know, makes it kind of a, you know, it's not a burden that I don't think this committee, you know, and it's not a burden per se, but it's something that we have to get the direction, and that's what I think the committee has to come up with. Mr. Fong.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple things. First of all, I would like to hear from Darren briefly, just for the benefit of our two new members, just a review of our current policy that we have, our asset allocation policy. A reminder, I think that's important. And then the other thing I think we ought to do, Mr. Chairman, before we make any decisions, we do have folks from the public here who might have some interest in offering some comments, to include members from the State Investment Board. So they I think might be interested in offering some comments. So.
Well, that's point well taken, and I think that's where, you know, and that. I wasn't going to make a decision or have us make a decision until we got all the parties included. So go ahead, Darren.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm Darren Schultz. The advisory board selected a asset mix in December of 2011, which was a recommendation that was made to the State Investment Board and accepted to structure the portfolio in a 100% fixed income. Mm-hmm. And it's 100% short-term fixed income mandates, which are currently managed by two managers, Babson Capital and JP Morgan. So it is a short-term fixed income 100% bond portfolio, which is how the fund is currently invested.
What's Darren, what's that costing? What's the management fees and stuff for something like that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a specific number at the top of my head. I would guess the management fee is perhaps, is it 30, I believe it's 35 basis points.
Okay.
Or I may be very off, actually. Is it lower than that?
About 35 basis points. Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I would point out that given the structure of the mandates, the portfolio is, you know, barely keeping a pace with inflation. Given that it's in short-term fixed income, the average annualized returns going back the last couple of years is around 2%. Relative to CPI, which is probably 1.6-1.7%. So in its current form, and in the absence of any spending, the focus of preserving corpus is challenged, given that it's invested entirely in short-term fixed income.
Okay. Mr. Fong, go ahead.
Darren, we spent quite a bit of time as a board developing that policy, and there's other things in that policy to include transparency, accountability, all of those features. So if we today make a decision about the asset mix, I assume that we can do that, and we would just insert those different, you know, proportions, and we don't need to mess with the remainder of the policy and the other features. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I think to reiterate what that we're just dealing, if we choose 55 or 50, right. you wouldn't pull everything out and reallocate it back out again. You know, if the rest stayed in equities or something, or fixed income or something like that, we wouldn't have to reallocate the whole fund, or you wouldn't have to reallocate the whole fund.
Mr. Chairman, I think Josh made a great point about the natural advantages that we have as far as cash flows in terms of working towards mm-hmm. an alternative policy. Mm-hmm. Those cash flows permit us to, as Josh mentioned, dollar cost average in, mm-hmm. and so that we could mm-hmm. work towards over time using mm-hmm. the large monthly cash flows that we're receiving to move into equities with the goal of ultimately working towards a policy allocation that R.V. Koons is recommending of 50%, yeah. 55, yeah. 60%, yeah. which
that's
based on the study would seem to be more appropriate given the long-term mm-hmm. investment horizon, the absence of liquidity needs near term. Just the, in general, the ability to take on more risk than we currently are.
Okay. Any, Mr. Hardmeyer?
Darren, you know, based on coming up with a recommendation today, does SIB have, you know, veto power over our decision? If we decide to go 60, 35, 5, or whatever we come up with, is that, you know, kind of cast in stone, or is that something that SIB will consider and make a independent decision of our recommendation, or do we have the final say? I guess I'm unclear.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hardmeyer, I believe it's the advisory board's role is to make a recommendation which the State Investment Board will accept as a matter of board governance. I'm turning towards Connie as far as veto power. Treasurer Schmidt, would you like to weigh in?
If you take our recommendation, that's it, or if there's, you know, other considerations that SIB makes in looking at that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hardmeyer, ultimately the State Investment Board would make the decision on whether to accept that recommendation or not. I'm afraid I can't provide any more color beyond that.
I have another question.
Okay, go ahead, Mr.
Earlier it was suggested that you may have room within your existing, you know, mandates or whatever that you could fit these investments in versus standalone. Can you tell us a little bit about how you might do that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hardmeyer, the point that Josh made regarding pooling is that it would allow the legacy fund to benefit from some cost efficiencies from having mandates aggregated within individual managers, and as a result we would achieve the ability to reach breakpoints, which would lower the investment management fee than if it was just a standalone portfolio. In addition, there are operational advantages as far as you know, managing the portfolio makes it just more efficient internally as far as.
So you could slide some of these investments in depending on how you decide that you want to do, whether you want to take a lump or you want to just start taking the cash flows. You have room within your availability.
That's correct.
So what you're saying, the money, so would not lose its identity per se, because it would be, as you invested it, even though it was in a pooled asset, it'd basically be a legacy fund number or whatever your investment number would be just that. It'd be the identity
it
of
is,
the
it
fund.
Is, it receives accounting treatment as a standalone entity, mm-hmm. but the pooling would allow us to realize cost savings both on management fees as well as operationally.
See, that's something, you know, go ahead, Ms. Sharp.
Mr. Chairman, I think that actually is a pretty good idea, but I think there is something in statute right now that says the legacy fund cannot be pooled. We need to look at that.
That's what I, that was, yeah, yeah. Thank, yeah, I, and that is,
it's our policy.
Okay.
I've been informed by Connie that it's a matter of policy, not statute.
Okay.
The pooling.
So well, that's our, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Pam, I think that was my point about, you know, we need to look at that, I think, a little closer, because that we spent a lot of time on that when we developed the original policy. So I think today what we're getting at, though, is that asset mix, and that's what we probably can decide today. But if there are other changes to the policy that we want to make, we probably are going to have a separate meeting on that, which would include pooling and some of the accountability and transparency features. But I don't think we're prepared to get into that today.
No, yeah, and that's, I wasn't sure.
It's not to say that it wouldn't be a good idea to revisit the pooling idea, but I just, I'm not sure we want to go there today.
Well, yeah, because we'd need to see if there was, you know, what kind of saving, you know, and you can see the reason why that discussion, you know, as we talk about it here, there was reasons why we did, you know, did that too at the time, and so, and yeah, we'd have to, that'd probably be a little more for this discussion. I'd like to try to get some comments too. Is there any other representative? Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Mr. Fong indicated, before I would want to see this fund pooled, I would want to see that we're going to really see some benefits from doing this. And you know, we're hearing that we will, but I want to, you know, I would want to see something laid out where, you know, I can be assured that we're going to see lower rates and real benefit from doing this. At this point, I'm a little uncomfortable with doing something like that.
Yeah, and I don't think we're, that's, like I said, that's a little beyond the scope of this meeting. I think the purpose of this was to kind of lay out where we're comfortable at and looking at the at where we're at with the allocations and our basically our returns. The allocations up to you. It's more of what kind of returns we're trying to aim towards. So, is there anybody else?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and mine may be more of a comment as a first timer here at the meeting, and certainly trying to listen and gather all this in and trying to understand the direction that the RV has brought to us and listening, because we are working on a program here on a pool of funds that we've heard that we're looking for generations. We're talking, this is something that well into the future, and certainly if I won't be in the legislature forever, but try to protect that fund, even though currently, I mean, there's been times we've already tried to invest to raid the fund. And we listen, we certainly are looking for returns. I don't know where, I'm still not to that point where, and as I listen to the group here, we're going to have to understand, I'm going to have to understand whether that 50% or 55 or 60, and certainly there's folks here that have listened to and been involved with this for some time. But we listen to, you know, what are the costs, the fees, you know, what is the future of our spending? What does the direction of the legislature? But I think today, I want to try to understand that, you know, certainly we don't want to see us do less than 1% now. I see that it was a beginning, it was a start. Fixed income seemed to be the way to go, whatever they decided and why they decided that. But understanding that that everybody seems to be getting a better rate. We don't, you know, I don't know that we're shooting for 12, but certainly, you know, as we look at things like TFFR and PERS and those retirement funds that make everybody nervous, that will, because we need those to stay forever. But certainly want to be comfortable with my decision that I've reached. And so I'm just hoping for there's further discussion here amongst this front table that will help me reach that decision today, and I appreciate the folks coming in. But you know, when you get the experts, you know, I've listened for an hour and a half or whatever, but still there's always questions, and they're not going to be here when I think of them, probably tomorrow morning at 4 o'clock.
Somebody called Darren.
there any other, Darren, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any else from the audience that wants to speak?
Committee, the two new members, it is new ground, obviously. If some of the members aren't comfortable with, and this is a sheet I think we're working, and I hope everybody's got this in front of them. Basically, it's the bottom part of this graph is what, it kind of gives you where the returns and the risks and kind of simplifies, maybe committee's comfortable where we're at. That's what I think, but I think what we've heard today is that I think in some of the comments we've heard in the hallways here the last first part of the session was that they weren't, this was underperforming what they were looking at, and so it's something that, But I came into this, looking. I was thinking that between, four to six, is what I kind of came into this looking at. As far as percentage returns, just kind of looking at what kind of inflationary factors, the spending. The spending part of this, is kind of an irrelevant conversation at this point, but was like pointed out is that at some point there is going to be money coming out of this. Our growth formula, the accumulation phase is one thing, and they had to get work with something, and stuff on it. I'm hoping it's a double that, maybe triple that number, at least what we've been indicated, that this is a 20-year play, but I've seen these things in the past disappear. Every time you start thinking they're going to last forever, they go away. So, we're probably about as aggressive as you want to get on what the accumulation part of this is on this. And if it keeps growing, I think that's, come into play, but at 4 years, you look at where you're at in 4 years, and at that time we got another change because in 4 years, it's going to be before any money comes out of this. It'll be 2019 before any money gets appropriated out of this fund. So it's so we got some time yet to accumulate just on interest and on the whole earnings part of it too, but
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, would it be your intentions that before we're done here today that we select one of these candidate portfolios, that we have a motion, vote on the motion, adopt one of these, and then give that information to the State Investment Board and then leave the implementation of how and when, how to stage the entry into that level would be up to them, or should we ask instruct them in that regard? I guess I'm not sure what you'd like to have us do, but I think that it would be in order to have a motion or to have some discussion on which one of these candidate portfolios we might want to adopt.
Go ahead, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would, if we could, I would like to at least have a couple of days on this. If we could come together just to make a motion to accept one of these. Or in this discussion this evening, I certainly like to hear why one or the other would be more obvious to choose. Risk is about the same, and whether you chose one, two or three, but I'd like to hear from the perspective, possibly from even the bank's perspective, those folks who are probably constantly looking to invest in small business across the state and taking risk and understanding risk better than I do. But I just at this point am just a little uncomfortable, but I'm waiting to hear from the gurus of the committee to give me comfort.
Well, yeah, Mr. Chairman, you know, I don't have a vast experience in looking at, you know, investment portfolios. You know, what we did talk about, though, Senator Klein, was the Norwegian model. Some of us went over to Norway last year, met with the individuals that run their global wealth fund, which is very similar to this fund, larger, started off in, you know, 1996 with their first contributions. Today it's $638 billion plus. And what's interesting is that they adopted a 60-35-5 model, 60% equities, 35% fixed income, 5% real estate. So, you know, the things that we're looking at here are quite similar to that. And you know, I could tell you that they put a tremendous amount of effort and work into looking at their model and their formula. I don't know that I have a recommendation based on that, but I could tell you that, you know, I get comfort in understanding what went into their decision making. So I, you know, I'm comfortable today, you know, making a decision that we move forward with one of these models, because I think that's the appropriate thing to do, and particularly when you consider some of the statements made about dollar cost averaging. I mean, we can't time the market. There's going to be ebbs and flows, but I mean, that's the beauty of dollar cost averaging, is you're going to hit some, you know, highs and lows, and eventually it works out. So that's the extent of my wisdom.
Thank you, Guru.
Yeah.
Well, and I think committee, and I think that, you know, and that brings up the point, and I think that Darren brought that up, that with the inflows that are coming in, we don't have to make, you know, what we've done in the past here, it's moving forward. We can use these monies moving forward, you know, that's showing up, you know, on a monthly basis here. We can move those forwards to a point, you know, to, if we're, you know, whatever number we come up with, but it we can move those forward without changing a lot of what we've already path we're on. You know, it's just a transition of the transition of it, and I think that's the whole point of what Mr. Hardmeyer was, is you'd average that out over the, you know, we got time, and we got, you know, so far the inflows have been coming in, so we don't have to, you know, it'd be a change in it, but we wouldn't have to change overnight of what we're doing today on it. Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and I guess Darren could ask you a question, if you would, please. Say we make a decision today. I'm not really familiar with the State Investment Board. Could you just give me a little bit of information? Who do you use for brokers? Why? Are they there forever, or do you do periodic review and shop around for lower rates as you know, do this investing to the best interest of our portfolio here now and for the state? Just a little history. I mean, I'd like to know that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kreit, the investment programs which the State Investment Board has oversight responsibility utilizes entirely external managers. We do not have internal investment management. We don't deal with broker-dealers. And as far as the manager selection process, we are looking at a universe of institutional-grade, fixed income, equity, real estate, other alternative investment managers in the hopes of finding managers that fulfill mandates that meet the investment objectives of our individual clients. Staff internally conducts due diligence, both monitoring of existing managers as well as looking at other managers that may be well suited for the various investment programs for which our office oversees. And with respect to, yeah, you know, the current investment managers in the legacy fund, Babson Capital and JP Morgan, are you know, excellent investment managers for managing short-term fixed income. If the advisory board were to look at alternative candidate portfolios, We would certainly look at the roster of existing as well as potentially other candidates to fulfill the mandates that our office has responsibility for overseeing.
Mm-hmm. Darren, do you have could we get a list of your who you use as managers now? Did you provide that to us? And could you, you know, of who you use and stuff on it, and who's registered, I guess, with you?
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to provide you a list of existing managers that
okay.
we currently utilize.
Okay. Okay. Is there any other questions for Darren? Okay. Thanks, Darren. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I do think, you know, even with our new members, Senator Klein and Representative Kreit, I think we do need to move forward and make some decisions today. I think that we have certainly learned from our experience so far, the first couple of years of managing this or advising, but I do think that today we could come out of here with some kind of a candidate portfolio that we all can agree on. And I guess, I don't know how you want to start this process, but I think that, you know, the consultants have suggested ranging between 50% and 60% equities, and so I'm using the page that you have pointed us all to. And, you know, I think we need to look at, you know, where do we want to be? What's the expected rate of return? And you know, I was a little hesitant to say that we would want to go that high, 50% to 60%. And based on your comments about trying to be somewhere between 4% and 6%, but still keeping in mind their recommendations, would it be appropriate, and I certainly could phrase this in the form of a motion, that we consider a 50% equity, which kind of threads the needle a little bit, Mr. Chairman. I think that we all are looking for better returns, and we think we can do that. I also am concerned about getting too much risk, and so that 55 to 60% range does concern me a bit. And so I guess I'm thinking that we could start the discussion with a motion of the 50% equities, which, looking at that column, we would be 50% equities, 35% fixed income, and then 5% in core real estate and 10% in diversified assets. So, Mr. Chairman, I move that we consider 50% and look forward to the discussion.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded by Mr. Fong and seconded by Mr. Hardmeyer that we move a motion forward of actually it's 50% equities. Discussion.
But Mr. Chairman, I'll second, but could I hear the numbers again?
Well,
the percentages.
Oh.
Page 25.
Yeah, it's on page 25. Basically, as it runs through, is
oh, okay. You're following what?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It's
okay.
U.S. broad equities is 30%. Broad international is 20. Fixed income's 35. Core real estate's 5.
Got it.
Diversified real assets are 10. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman. It would seem to me that we're going to select one of those three, and we're going to select one of those three. I'm going to be on the side of the 50%. I've heard the commissioner to my left suggest that we're looking for a conservative as approach as we can. We still want to build a fund, but we want to go beyond the 1% that we're at. You know, in anything we do here, there's risk, and I know that's it's one of those things that we're going to have to face, but. I guess with that, it's more of a comment that I would be probably, if I'm going to be comfortable with any one of those columns, it's going to be on the 50% column.
Ed, Mr. Fong.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Klein and other members, remember the recommendation from Harvey Coons that we need to look at this again within the next, you know, 4 to 5 years. And I think most notably, we want to take another look at this before the spending starts, which would be, you know, somewhere before that 2017, well, actually 2019 is when the legislature actually would have the ability to spend. So, you know, I think that falls in line with this policy being in place. It's a more more conservative of the recommendation, and we would want to reevaluate and revisit this in the next, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Well, in committee too, you know, I mean, we're, you know, it will be this committee, we won't, they'll actually will be meeting more than once every 4 years, but it's not my intent to meet very often. I know that once you, because it doesn't pay to try to, you know, we're not going to micromanage this at all, but, you know, I think once a year, I'm sure there, we got some issues though yet that was brought up earlier about some of the pooling language and some of that stuff that we're going to have to visit about, you know, going forward with this. But I think, you know, it's kind of my intent that, you know, once a year probably that a person, you know, see what fee management fees and see what kind of get an idea, you know, just kind of so we're aware of what's going on and stuff, that person would have an annual report or something on it. And but it's basically, you know, I think once we get this done, I don't think we're going to, if things are working right, we aren't going to be visiting it very often.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, my comment was only to the extent that it applies to setting this asset class. I realize, and our policy actually requires us to get together more often to hear about the returns from the State Investment Office. So that was only intended to imply that we would revisit this issue of the allocation in, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. Well, when we've been out on the campaign trail, we've been suggested we meet 2 days every 80 years. So it, we lost a member. Huh?
I think it'll be right back.
Oh, okay. Well, we can stand at ease here. You know, if there's no other comments, you know, I think the next thing we need to do is vote, I guess, is going to be the next conversation. Yeah, we'll have to take a roll call on this.
Representative Kempinick?
Yes.
Representative Crate?
Yeah.
Senator Dawson Rod?
Yes.
Senator Klein?
Aye.
Ms. Sharp?
Yes.
Mr. Hardmeyer?
Yes.
Mr. Fong?
Yes.
Okay, the motion carries. Well, committee, I think we've kind of laid some groundwork here. We'll see how we roll it out. Anybody have any comments from Darren?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, given the decision to revise the policy of the legacy fund, I would encourage the board so that staff can begin implementing this immediately to reconsider the policy restriction, which requires the assets not to be pooled with other funds. This simply, we would not be able to implement based on the revised policy allocation unless we were to lift that restriction and allow us to pool with other insurance assets, which the legacy fund would benefit from having an additional $2 billion to enjoy savings on management fees, as well as certainly it would make staff, make the lives of staff members much easier. And so I would really encourage the board to reconsider that policy restriction and allow pooling going forward.
Your comments are well taken, and I think we're going to, Treasurer, when's the next, is that at the end of the month? Okay, well, hopefully, I mean, we'll meet again. I mean, because everybody that needs to be is here. You know, we're going to meet before we're out of session, so we aren't calling a meeting back before we get done with this. But I think it was indicated that members wanted to have a few days to kind of talk that part over, but we'll have to have another meeting here before we leave on that issue, and so that's point well taken. It is. Well, because as long as everybody's still here yet, that shouldn't be a problem to have a meeting and discuss that, but we don't need to tie up. That could take a while. I mean, I think you made some well points, but I think people need to think about it. So, Mr. Fong.
Mr. Chairman, a request to Connie or someone from the State Investment Office, if you could send us all or send Legislative Council a version of our current policy so we can all start taking a look at that and kind of reviewing the other areas that we might want to consider making any changes to include the pooling policy piece of it. And I think we need to clarify, as Ms. Sharp pointed out, she thinks it's statutory, so I think we need to confirm whether or not it is a policy or statutory, even though I think it is our policy. So, thank you.
Yeah, well, if it's statute, I mean, we got time to do that too, but we gotta do it before we leave. It is. Is there any other questions, comments?
Mr. Chairman, in addition to what Corey's asked for, I would be interested to see the implementation strategy that Darren and his crew would take in terms of how they would begin to start investing the money. I'm curious how you'd like to do that, and would like to hear a presentation on that.
Point well taken. Mr. Fong.
Last comment is just thanks to RV Coons and the associates who are here today for taking the time and the work that you put into this. We really appreciate it, and you know, we look forward to, I assume, continuing to work with you as we go through this to evaluate, and so we appreciate all the effort.
Yeah, thank you, and that's something, because it like I said, it laid it out very well, and I appreciate the effort you put into it, and I think it's helped us greatly. It has, and I don't know how do you on this, and I guess that is a question. Is there any follow up or anything that RV? Do you guys, or you know, in this, or as we lay stuff out, or later on, or how does that all work on with you folks? I mean, this is pretty much the end of the what we requested of you and stuff on it, and so I didn't know how you all work on that. But I think it's like I said, going forward here, we'll probably look at it here later on this year and see how things, you know, see where we're at, and then go from there if there's isn't anything else that we need. Thank you for your time, and safe travels home. It is. With that, Darren's got some stuff there. I think what I got in mind here, if we got to meet again, I'm thinking I got to look at the schedule of every, you know, of when we can get a room, basically, but we should start freeing up some stuff here, because I think we're getting through with the committee hearings. But I'm hoping that we can probably towards the end of next week or the first part of the following week, we'll have to look at some schedules and stuff, but you'll get notices. And like I said, everybody's here yet, so.
I'm usually here by 6 in the morning.
Oh, are you? I don't know. Pam, what time are you? So with that, I think we're through for today, so we'll just adjourn. Oh, got too many buttons on. Yes, Josh.